You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Friday, June 18th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Yeah, this is an afternoon. We are doing a live stream of the recording of the show, so there's a number of people who are watching and listening to us as we record it. We've done a few of these in the past, but it's been a while as the technology has evolved. I think we should do more of these, right? Assuming this all works out.
Yeah, let's see how this goes first.
Yeah. I mean, there's no reason why we can't do that for patrons. You know, give as much extra content to our patrons as possible. Kara, you haven't been to one of these in a while.
No, it looks different.
What you been doing?
Oh, you know, just like PhDing.
Yeah, it's nothing big.
Just all that. Oh my gosh, it's so, this semester especially. It's like when you're finished with all your classes, that's not when it gets easier. That's when it gets much harder because I'm seeing patients. I'm working on my quals, the second half of my qualifying exam, and finishing my proposal so that I can become a PhD candidate at the end of summer and apply for the internship. I'm also doing a daily television show on PBS. So it's a lot.
Every day you're doing that?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's every day. That's why That's why my camera's so fancy. I'm actually on a Sony A7. Fancy whole rig with nice lights and stuff.
Yeah, your lighting is very good. I could tell just by looking. It's very
and
different.
And looks super nice camera. But usually I don't have the headphones or the microphone. They're all out of frame and you wouldn't be able to tell. But This is a podcast.
Yeah, I was contacted recently by a Russian TV network.
Da.
But that streams in outside of Russia, like in the United States and Europe. And they wanted to do a segment on spontaneous human combustion.
Oh, my God.
I'm like, sure. I'll
still?
Do that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'll do that. Then I get a follow-up email. It says, one question. Do you think it's real or not?
And well, it's a valid question.
I don't think that it's real. And I haven't heard back from them, strangely. So I don't know how to interpret that.
Boy, I wonder what they're going for. That's one of those things when you understand what spontaneous human combustion is actually saying, when you understand like what they're supposing, it's so absurd, it's mind-blowing.
It's one of those things that you have to think about it for just a minute, but also you need a slight amount of scientific literacy. I think if science is a big black box to you, then you're like, yeah, sure, people burst into flames. Okay, what's the big deal? But yeah, if you think about it, that's why like one of the real big proponents of spontaneous human combustion actually invented a new particle of physics not found in the standard model, right? The pyrotron or something, to explain how this could happen. Right. Like if you're making up new physics sort of off the cuff to explain your phenomenon, you have a problem.
That's usually frowned upon.
I really like that idea of a science as a big black box. What's in the box?
What's in the box?
Gwyneth Paltrow's head.
Yeah, that's true.
Who knew? Thought it was a cat.
There's goop in the box. So what's the oldest computer medium you guys still have hanging around?
I have Jazz Drives.
Oh, boy.
Jeez. I got a floppy.
I have a floppy somewhere. A hard floppy.
Why do you keep these things?
In case there's important data on it.
It's just accidental. Right. It's like, oh, I got to throw that out someday.
Is
and then
the
I forget about it.
Three and a half inch disc?
I think right? I needed my assistant to transcribe something for me. And the other day, I was like, oh, I'll just throw it on a flash drive real quick. And it was a video. And it turned out that it was 20 megs. And so none of my flash drives were big enough.
For 20 megs?
No, 20 gigs. Sorry, 20 gigs.
Okay.
Whoa. For 20 gigs?
But yeah, none of my flash drives were 20 gigs. And so I was like, crap. And I had to pull out an old external hard drive and then wait for it to transfer. So I guess all my tiny flash drives that are only like 1 or 2 gigs, that would be, or maybe I do have a stack of CDs somewhere, but I don't have a CD drive.
So that's your oldest medium is old USB drives.
I mean, I used hard disks in college. I used diskettes a lot, but like, I don't keep any of that crap. I already transferred it all.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Why would
to
I
do.
Keep that?
So when you were in college, you were using the 3.5-inch disks?
Yeah, I was using the diskettes, not the floppies.
Not the floppies.
In college. Yeah. Like, that's I know retro. That my undergrad thesis, the disk corrupted, and I was so distraught that I paid another person to retype my whole thesis.
Because I had a backup copy, huh?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Guys, look at this.
Was that your lipstick? Mm-hmm. What is that?
I can't.
What's the...
64 meg. 64 meg.
Oh, mega.
This that's, was magic. Yeah, when I got this, what, 80 years ago? This
you pay
was
for
magic. I mean...
Would you pay $100 for that?
Oh, my thing? God. 64 meg. When you're... Because this was like transitioning from, you know, 1.44 megs floppy, and soon after that I got this, and to me that was just like cavernous.
Bob, is that your oldest piece of technology that was like just within reach?
Yes, within,
like, within
reach.
Not having to leave frame.
It's in my
I think I have
in my thumb drive skull.
So does it freak you guys out? Does it freak you guys out at all that you can't, what would you do with like an old floppy drive today? Like, think about how difficult it would be to get the data off of that. It's not just getting the data off; it's being able to read the files.
Mm-hmm. I can.
No,
I'm
you
sure
send
I'm,
it somewhere. There's yeah, there are people
oh, yeah,
that
there's
do
conversion
this.
Services
I recently
all
got
over
all
the place.
My VHSs digitized.
Yeah, VHS.
Yeah.
How
and
much
then
was
I
that?
I got rid of that. I don't think it was cheap.
No, it's not cheap.
I didn't have that many, but now I have all those files just on my computer, so I don't have the VHSs anymore.
So I always copy all of my stuff forward. So it's never only on older, you know, media. Mm-hmm. But I did have a folder that I've been copying forward for over 20 years that had a bunch of text documents, word processor documents in them.
Oh, yeah. That's mostly what
I cannot access that data because I have no application that will read it. It's just a garbled mess. It was, I don't know if it was... What was before Word? What was that one that application?
It was
it was Word. There was right. So you had WordPad,
WordPerfect.
Right? WordPerfect. I think they were WordPerfect files.
Yeah, somebody has a program.
Whatever.
That'll do that. But yeah, you know. Do you really want to mess with it?
Well, we talked about this once, like a storage vault for all medium in the future. Would they be able to really access it? Would they lose the ability to do that?
It's sort of similar, but in the opposite to the thought experiment around the places where radioactive waste is stored. And how do you sign out to people 5,000 years in the future?
Graphics, pictures of people. You know, that
with like
melting,
with like
people melting.
Yeah, you could do it. So someone says, why don't you look at it with like RTF, like just as a text file? I did that. And it's basically like, imagine like 20 pages of...
Wingdings,
special care, of nonsense, and then you have completely unformatted text after that, right?
Right.
And so yeah, the text was in there. That actually wasn't what I was going for because it was a heavily formatted word processor files.
Yeah,
because I had like tables and stuff like that, so it was just kind of worthless to me as just like completely unformatted text.
Evan.
Dang, yes.
How, actually, I should ask the people in the chat who are like live listening right now. Oh. How many of you who are like under the age of 30 know what Evan is talking about when he says the word wingdings?
That's a good
like, I don't even know if that reference would translate.
Carol, that's a
Did I
question.
Tell you guys
oh my gosh.
About how my friend who has a millennial daughter was saying that when you ask, like, when you motion like you're on the phone, that younger people do it like this?
Of course.
Not
oh,
like
that's
this.
What they do.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Oh,
she,
I see. Right.
She asked my friend, hey, how do you like motion that you're on the phone? She was like this. And she goes, ha ha, you're so old.
So
I do it like this.
And for the people listening to the podcast, right. So Kara, the old people put their thumb in their pinky out.
Yeah, like a hang loose symbol.
Yeah, the Hawaiian.
But up to their
right.
face.
But digits younger people just make a cup with their hand like they're holding a cell phone.
Yeah, like a Lego hand.
Right.
And they hold that up to their head.
And Evan was saying really old people like Mr. Burns would hold like those. What would they call them? Like the not a banana phone. They were the...
It was before the rotary phone.
It was like a daffodil phone, right?
Banana phone.
What?
Is that what it was called?
Is that the one that Evan just did?
with the separate earpiece and a cord and into the
microphone closet or like a cubby built into the house for them.
Yes, the phone.
I think this, the step after that, Kara, is just putting a finger to your ear, like, because we're gonna have like little implants in there. You know what I mean?
Well, I do that now when I'm on set and I have an earpiece. And you see this too with crew who has to wear an earpiece on set, because you get this crazy look in your eyes when somebody starts talking to you in a secret earpiece.
Yeah.
Like, you're having a conversation with somebody, blah, 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 blah. And then your producer starts talking and you go like this.
Yeah, right. You...
And then the person talking to you is like, are you having a stroke? What's happening? And so if you hold your finger up to your ear, it kind of signals to everybody somebody is communicating with me in secret. Right.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
In secret, not so secret anymore.
Yeah.
All right, Bob, so you haven't done a forgotten superhero of science in a while. So you're going to do a triple threat today.
So welcome to Forgotten Superheroes of Science. Today's a threefer. I got three people. Jocelyn Crane Griffin, 1909 to 1998. Gloria Hollister Annibal, 1900 to 1988. And Elsie Bosselman, 1882 to 1961. So what did they have in common?
They died really old.
A bathysphere plus that. So William Beebe and Otis Barton designed the first ever bathysphere in the late 20s, early 1930s. This is a bathysphere, if you're not familiar, it's just a spherical metal submersible that's lowered by cable. And they went down to record depths back in the 30s. This is like 1930 to 1934. And this was part of the Bermuda Oceanographic Expedition at the New York Zoological Society's Department for Tropical Research. Now, in Bermuda at that time, they were the very first to observe deep sea wildlife in their natural environment. Had never been done before, and this was an absolute first, a very exciting first. These were pioneers. Now, critical members of Beebe's team were these three women that I mentioned. So I'll hit each of them real quickly. Not physically, I mean, what you know what I mean. So Jocelyn Crane Griffin. She was a laboratory assistant and a carcinologist. Who knows what a carcinologist is?
Johnny Carson expert.
Cancer, right?
Cancer-causing
materials?
Crustacean expert. So she was a crustacean expert.
Oh.
And later in her career, she was a prominent expert in ethology, studying the behavior of tropical animals like jumping spiders, praying mantises, etc. But her love was fiddler crabs, and she wrote a seminal work on them in 1975 called Fiddler Crabs of the World. The next one is Gloria Hollister Annibal. She was a scientist and a conservationist. She served as a research associate on the team, and her job was keeping that critical line of communication with the crew. So if she wasn't in the bathysphere, she was on land, keeping that line of communication open between, you know, the bathysphere and the ship. Very critical. You did not want to lose that communication. Later in her career, Annibal became, she joined the American National Red Cross, and she helped found the nation's first blood supply, the Blood Donor Center in Brooklyn. That's pretty amazing. And then finally, we've got Elsie Bosselman. She was the artist on the team. She had fantastic illustrations of deep sea life that she brought to life, and was also in many issues of National Geographic. Now, apparently, also she did some amazing artwork with newly discovered creatures that were bioluminescent, and apparently that was a really big event for oceanographers at the time. Later in her career, she illustrated and published 14 children's books. She even had textiles like towels and rugs and handbags that were made and sold at Macy's department stores in New York City. So that was or in Manhattan. That's pretty cool. Now, Griffin and Annibal, they broke records when they descended in the bathysphere as deep as 1,200 feet. Elsie Bosselman did not go into the bathysphere. Project lead Beebe, he was criticized by colleagues. I really love this, what he said. He was criticized by colleagues for daring to hire women for such a pioneering scientific expedition. Some described it as a deprofessionalization of the field. I mean, give me a break. Beebe dismissively said, "Peh!" And he added, you like that, Jed? That was for you. He added that he hired women for the bathysphere team due to merit because of their sound ideas and scientific research. I mean, that's what else? What other reasons do you need to hire anybody, right? That's all that matters. So remember, Crane, Hollister, and Bosselman, mention them to your friends, perhaps when talking about benthoscopes, mesopelagic fish, or especially echinoids and osmoregulation.
Cool.
Meso what, Bob?
Mesopelagic fish.
Wow.
Fish at deep ocean, but the mid-deep, not the crazy deep, but mid-deep that a bathysphere could reach.
Mm-hmm. Not the Marianas Trench.
No.
All right. So, Jay, there's not going to be any Who's That Noisy this week because we're recording the show too early because
partly because
you and I are both going to be out of town in a couple weeks.
Yep.
But you are going to do a news item about noisy thinking.
I am. So this is based on a new book that came out. And I think this is very relevant to skeptics. Once you wrap your head around this idea, I think, you know, a lot of people might benefit from reading this book. I am definitely going to read this book, and I would love to get one of the authors on. But so let's jump right in. So a new book, it's called Noise, A Flaw in Human Judgment. This was written by a Nobel Prize winner, Daniel Kahneman, Professor Oliver Siboney, and Cass Sunstein. In the book, though, they explain the differences between bias, and it introduces bias, which introduces a predictable and systematic change in perspective, right? You know what bias is. And noise, there's something that they define as noise. And this is something that they call random scatter. So think of noise like there's a myriad of influences that can dramatically alter any decision that you make, and which I'll get into detail about that. And that's noise. So a good visual example of bias versus noise is shooting bullets at a target. So where bias would be targets that are all grouped together off center, noise is everywhere. So noise is just chaos. The book's focus.
And Jay, we should point out that you know who Kahneman is, right?
I do.
Yeah, but he's the
guy. Thinking Fast and Slow.
Yeah, Thinking Fast and Slow is also basically came up with the whole idea of heuristics, of
yeah,
systematic errors in the way we analyze information.
And System 1 and System 2 thinking, sort of.
He's
like
kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I tried to get him on the show, actually, not too long ago, but the answer, because he's at Yale.
Yeah.
But the answer is he's retired and he doesn't do interviews anymore.
Too bad.
Very, very old. Yeah, we just missed his career, I guess. I didn't realize he had another book in the chamber, but I guess, you know, he's working with the co-authors who are also excellent, you know, researchers in this area.
So the three authors focus on this idea of noise and what can you do about it? You know, being that we're all heavily influenced by it. So ultimately, the book makes the point that noise is as influential as bias is, right? So think about your own bias or the concept of a bias and how it dramatically affects the way that people think. Noise has a similar, if not the same, amount of influence over your thinking. But it's very hard to just point the finger at it to identify because of how many different things it is. So ultimately, the book makes the point, you know, that noise is something that can be dealt with, which is fantastic. Both of them definitely waste time, right? Bias and noise are big time and money wasters, but they both can have physiological, psychological ramifications, you know, to mental health. And they can also neutralize justice, which, you know, is rampant, essentially worldwide. You know, when you think of the concept of justice and how many ways it could be skewed, it's actually a horrifying thing to quantify when you think about how unjust the world actually is. It's a little problem I have with reality, but we can get into that later. So let me further define noise as it's described in the book. So a person's ability to evaluate a situation is heavily based on their own ability to make judgments, right? So the person has to essentially settle on a specific choice that's dependent on their evaluations. And this combination makes up what the authors call a noisy system. So noise can influence virtually everyone, but imagine how important that dealing with noise would be to a judge who's presiding over a criminal case, or imagine a detective who's trying to solve some type of crime. You know, they're dealing with their own biases, and then they're dealing with a lot of different things. And noise, though, is a collection of all of these outer influences. So let's get into a little bit more of the details here. Let me give you another example. There was a study where 22 physicians examined the exact same 13 angiograms two separate times, split up months apart, right? So you see the angiogram for the first time, you judge it, you give your prognosis, then 3 or 4 months later, you do it the same exact, you know, same exact information, and you give another prognosis. The doctors disagreed with their first prognosis 63 to 92% of the time. Whoa, that's huge. It's fascinating to think, though, that this can happen. But what is the underlying cause? So the authors explain that a person's mood and how well slept they are can factor in. Right? I know, it seems a little obvious, but it's scary, though, when you think that your doctor could have had a bad night. You have no idea. And their prognosis is dependent on, to some degree, and not an irrelevant amount, how much sleep they got, 6 hours ago. The authors explain that a person's mood can change throughout the day, right? It could just be you feel different, earlier in the day than later. So literally bad weather can influence a person's decision making. Other factors mm-hmm. could be, like I said, the time of day. Like, it's well known that if you're being judged, say in a court case, you want your court case to be handled when, guys? Do you know what the
I think in the morning,
say?
Right?
Probably.
And right after lunch. Really? The morning and right after lunch.
During nap time?
Yep. So wow. What happens to you in a courtroom equates to a judge's level of tiredness and also if they're hungry or not.
So you don't want, right before lunch, they're going to be hangry.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know how I am. When I get into a bad mood, I mean, everything could turn dark in my head, right? So in 1974, that study that was done with the doctors they did a study with 50 judges who were evaluating cases, and they were setting sentences for identical hypothetical cases, right? So one study found that the sentencing varied wildly between different judges. So one of the examples was a heroin dealer, right? Mm-hmm. So they come up with this idea of a heroin dealer, and what would the judge sentence that person to? They sentenced – the judges had a spectrum of 1 to 10 years, which is a pretty big spectrum, thinking, well, what are they using as their criteria? They're getting the same exact information. It's literally on paper. This is the person. They're not even looking at a person's face. And they had a 1 to 10 year span difference in the judgments that they're supposed to make. And this is kind of supposed to be formulaic, just so you know. It's like, what kind of crime did they commit? This is what they should get for it.
AI judges in the
right,
future
I know. And here we go.
Rule out these biases
yes.
and fluctuations.
Yes, they That's, will.
So a bank robber was sentenced to 5 to 18 years. Now, when I say this, I'm saying that these 50 judges had a difference between 5 and 18 years. Similar studies were done in the late 70s and early 80s, and they came to the same conclusion, right? This is just they keep repeating the same. They're coming up with the same exact conclusion with similar studies. So noise has a dramatic effect on people's decision making. It goes on to explain how to deal with noise, which is great because, it would be horrible for them to write this book without telling you how to handle or deal with it. So they say that we could use, this might sound silly, but like use algorithms. What the hell does that mean? Well, the book goes into it. They want you to use rules and guidelines. And they say, that we have, how we have a skeptical toolbox? They have something similar that they call to reduce noise in their lives. It's like a noise toolbox that they want you to develop. So it's like, like you said, heuristic, Steve. They mm-hmm. want you to come up with like these heuristics on how to deal with noise and how to edit it out of your life as much as possible. They call that a noise audit. And I think we should have a skeptical audit. Just saying. Mm-hmm. The difference between being totally, total credulity and perfect skepticism. We should come up with some type of test just for fun.
So, Jay, a couple of comments at this point. So there already is a lot of that noise reduction algorithms in science, in medicine.
Yeah.
So like what you're referring to when you say like you read a study and then you read it again, the same person reads the same study at a different time the next day, 3 months later or whatever, we call that intra-rater reliability,
mm-hmm.
right? You're comparing the same rater to themselves at a different time and you measure how much in alignment they are. Now, if there's a lot of noise, right, if the same person using the same scale comes up with a different answer, then that means that the scale is not very good. It's too subjective. It is too prone to noise, to variables. Or if you could have inter-rater reliability where you have Dr. A compared to Dr. B, and if that's different, then again, that indicates that it's subjective, that different people can read it differently and not apply it the same way. And so often in order to validate some kind of a measure system, you do inter and intra-rater reliability to make sure that the noise isn't too great, because then what do you get, right? This is all getting to signal-to-noise ratio. Mm-hmm. In science, we want the signal to be big and the noise to be small. And we actually measure that sometimes, right? We want to know that the noise is less than the signal.
Right. And even more specifically, what we're looking at when we look at things like inter-rater reliability or split half reliability is something specific that's called reliability, which is slightly different than validity, both of which contribute to noise. So validity is how much does this thing do what it says it does? Mm-hmm. And reliability is how consistently does it do that? Mm-hmm. So something can be completely invalid, but super reliable because it does reliably the same invalid, thing over and yeah. over. Yeah. Yeah. And something can be really, really valid, but not very reliable. But really what you want is both. You want a measure or some sort of tool to be highly valid and highly reliable.
But I think
that's a way to reduce the noise.
I think part of the problem here, though, is that the people that we're talking about that we want to use that these methods, right? They have to be conscious of it and willing to do that. And that's what's funny. Like when you talk about someone being hangry or tired, like that noise could counteract these measures, right, Steve? And Kara, don't you feel like, you know, it's the human element. It's a human element that you have to overcome.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so the idea is that let's make the actual algorithm, let's make the actual tool, the actual, whether it be a psychometric tool like a test or the checklist that's used, as stringent as possible so that we can reduce the level of variability that's introduced by humans.
Yep.
You also want the whatever you're evaluating to be objective versus subjective. But right. when you get to things like a judge giving a sentence, let's say, it's tough because you obviously want it to be consistent, right, mm-hmm. reliable. You don't want there to be a lot of random noise, like is the judge tired or hungry? But if you squeeze all of the judgment out of it, which sometimes states will do that, they'll pass laws that say if you're guilty of this crime, this is your sentence. There's no judgment.
Yeah, minimum, they're called maximum, mandatory right? minimums. Yeah, mandatory and they're actually minimum. Very unjust.
Yeah, they're not. They're very bad because then you remove the ability to take into consideration important but subjective things like yeah. mm-hmm. are there any extenuating circumstances or it was you know, how much remorse is being shown or whatever. But the problem is when you have those subjective things, then that also opens. So you might, you know, it not only opens the door for noise, but also for bias. And sure. right, then those subjective judgments then could easily be systematically biased against certain populations like minorities. So
yeah,
it's
why
tough.
Judges tough. Are supposed to be able to use judgment. I mean, it's, you know, but the problem is, you know, it can go either way.
Yeah.
It can be too harsh or too lenient.
Yeah. And so another way to do it, Jay, is to have multiple people, you know, and then you take an average, you crowdsource in some way. So if you had three judges, for example, make a decision, you take the average of them, that might, you know, average out that noise. May not average out bias as well if they're all biased. But
so you mean like
that's kind of the like from purpose of a jury of our peers
yeah.
as opposed to a judge only trial.
Yeah, we need that thing from Superman 1 when Zod was standing
yes.
in the two rings and you got all those
guilty.
Guys.
Guilty.
Yeah.
yeah.
So Steve and Kara and everyone, I hear what you're saying and I agree. But I do think, though, again, the human element here is the destructive force.
But it can also be the kind and the thoughtful force.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And that's what we have to remember, too.
I mean, there's no substitute for judgment. That's the bottom line. And even in science, like as objective as we try to make everything, at the end of the day, somebody who knows what they're talking about has to decide how important something is, how relevant
yep.
it is. Because as we, that's where motivated reasoning comes in, right? Even a little bit of motivated reasoning, and you could talk your way into dismissing yep. studies that you don't like the results of, or giving a pass to other ones that may have problems, but you do like
sure.
their results. It's very easy to do that. And so, you know, there's, I don't know of any way to completely factor judgment out of the equation.
Well, I think the best thing to do is to involve the judgment of more people.
Yeah.
It's to include people from different backgrounds,
yeah.
to include people from different power dynamics, and allow them to work together in a panel type situation. That's why you usually see that, like, within a hospital setting, for example, if one doctor disagrees with another doctor and they can't move forward, then it might go before an ethics board.
Yeah.
And that's why there are boards like that, because sometimes
yeah.
this judgment and this judgment, you know, there's different levels of noise that are causing conflict. And so, the you know, you get people whose whose expertise
we do have that to some degree. The appellate courts are that are designed that way.
Yeah, for sure.
To close this down, this book sounds like a book that skeptics should read. Just more tools, right? More tools to get closer to the truth.
Yeah, anything that helps you think about your own thinking, right? Yeah. Metacognition. Yeah.
Metacognition.
Yeah. Core to skepticism. Okay, Kara, this is really cool. Like when you wrap your head around what they're saying here, tell us about T-Rex teenagers.
Is that a new
They're punks. They're all punks.
Cartoonists.
They are punks. Show? They're punks that apparently ate everything. So here's an interesting study because paleontologists have long speculated about a very specific gap in certain groups of dinosaurs. And so I'm actually going to intro this article by reading a quote by the lead author, because I think it really encapsulates beautifully exactly what happened here. The lead author, whose name is Dr. Thomas Holt, says, and he's at the University of Maryland, he says, "Earlier in the history of dinosaurs, in most communities, you'd have a bunch of different types of carnivores of various size ranges, from small fox-sized all the way up to the occasional giants. Then something happens between 95 and 80 million years ago, where we see a shift. The really big carnivores, larger than an elephant, like Tyrannosaurus and their kin, become the apex predators. And the middle-sized predators, say like leopard to buffalo-sized carnivores, they're either missing or they're very rare." And so these researchers were like, why is that happening? Let's try and figure it out. And for a long time, the idea, the hypothesis, and actually the standing theory was somehow the prey wasn't there. So there wasn't enough prey for these mid-sized predators to be able to eat. And if the prey's missing, then of course you're not going to have the right predators. So you're going to get this weird shift where you've got really small things and really big things, but nothing in between. But what these researchers did is they sampled 60 sites around the world, 60 paleontological sites, and they looked at the different levels of predation. So they actually looked at the size of the bones and like who would be prey, who would be predator, all that good stuff. And they looked at a big gap in time, 201 to 66 million years ago. And they showed that in 29 of these 60 communities, T-Rex were the biggest predators. They were like the most dominant, and they just like had the most food available to them. These communities were specifically mostly in Asia, Central Asia, and North America. And they found that within those communities, things that weighed between like 50 kilograms and 1,000 kilograms just didn't exist. They were either gone or really, really rare. And only in a smaller time band from about 80 to 66 million years ago. So kind of reinforce this idea, okay, just these middle-sized predators aren't there. But then they were like, let's look at all the prey species and see if there's a link. Like there are fewer prey species at the time when there are fewer mid-sized predators. Or maybe there are more. So there were like two different hypotheses here, you know. Maybe prey species increased dramatically in the absence of predators, or maybe prey species dropped off, which led then to a disappearance of these mid-sized predators. And what they found was that there was no change whatsoever in prey diversity. They were like, this is so weird. All the prey species are still there. What could be explaining this, this shift? Why are there so few mid-sized predators? And so their explanation is that before T-Rex was full grown, before it was a 1,000-kilogram, you know, behemoth, it was a juvenile, and it may have had a slower lifespan. And maybe these juvenile T-Rexes, which were more agile, more hungry because they were growing, were actually filling the ecological niche of a lot of those mid-sized predators. And they're getting a lot of support for this hypothesis. It seems to fit the data. They do caution that, of course, there could be a third variable present. For example, a different explanation would be that something else killed off these other carnivores, and then, you know, the juvenile T-Rex stepped in and kind of filled up that ecological niche. There's no way to know, or at least the studies that have been done don't answer that specific question. But as of right now, these researchers are putting forth this hypothesis that maybe the reason all these other mid-sized predators are missing is not because the prey was gone, but because juvenile T-Rex was outperforming them.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, you don't think of an animal filling a different niche at different times of its life.
Of its life cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, you would think, like, if you just look at the fossil evidence, it would be missing, like, the mid-sized predators would be missing if they were just younger, big-sized carnivores. Because, I mean, obviously, some of them are going to die at all ages, but most of them are going to just become big T-Rexes, adult T-Rexes.
Right, right. Yeah, if they live, they're going to get big. And we're talking over 1,000 kilograms big.
So there's not going to be a separate fossil, you know, reservoir of mid-sized predators because they became full-sized predators.
And if you're interested, I've mentioned this on the show before, if you are ever in the Los Angeles area and you're interested in some new kind of evidence and a really good museum display that describes this, visit the Los Angeles County Museum of Natural History, because they actually have a T-Rex growth series where they have a very young T-Rex skeleton, a full-sized adult, and a juvenile to show the difference in the morphology. And they talk about how historically these were actually thought to be completely different species, different theropod species, until they started to get enough specimens to say, no, this is actually very likely just a different point in time mm-hmm. of a similar species. You know, we often think that the bones that we have is just what we've got, and that's what that species looked like. But oftentimes, we're defining whole species on a handful of bones.
Yeah.
So the more prevalent an organism like a T-Rex, or a lot of T-Rex specimens out there, the more that we start to be able to paint a full picture, which is super cool.
Yeah, and we talked about this before, the fact that some dinosaur species do change a lot in morphology as they get older. You know, their yeah. horns and frills and all that could change significantly. And we could be, yeah, sometimes we don't know. Is this two different ages of the same species, or two different species, or genera? Like that was a big debate about Triceratops and Torosaurus, right? And two different schools of thought. I forget which one. I think that the fact that they're two different genera kind of became dominant, but I'm not 100% sure.
But it's definitely, it's interesting when it's like, well, maybe it grew that horn thing later in life.
Yeah, right.
Maybe, you know, like massive morphological changes that we didn't get to observe the life cycle. And we can see that now. I mean, think about how different some young animals look than their adult counterparts.
Okay, let's move on. So this is interesting. I think it's going to be a short news item. But what do you guys think about this? The role of video games in mental health, just as a general, good, bad. What do you think?
I think it's really interesting because I was talking about this. Sorry, this is going to be a quick aside, Steve.
Go ahead.
I was talking about this with a neuropsychologist just this week when I was in clinic, and I saw that somebody had recommended Lumosity as a rehab mechanism. And I was like, oh no, we talk about Lumosity all the time on the show. And we talk about how it really only makes you good at doing Lumosity. And the rehab neuropsychologist was saying, absolutely, we know that that's what the evidence shows. And when we're talking about rehab, we're not talking about global improvements. We're not talking about an individual, for example, regaining speech by doing Lumosity. But what we do find is that there's a certain amount in cognitive behavioral theory of activation energy that's necessary. Mm-hmm. And when patients are engaging in rehab for the first time, doing something is often better than doing nothing. And doing something that gets them cognitively engaged can be a really good first step to downstream rehab efforts. And so I think from that perspective, video games, even if they're not specifically tied to improvements in outcome, could be really beneficial for a mental health patient who's dealing with low levels of activation energy or anhedonia, et cetera.
Yeah, definitely.
But are you also saying that any activity would show a benefit?
Possibly.
Potentially, but remember that a video game has a lot of unique qualities to it. You can do it independently. It's something where you can get feedback. A lot of these video games can actually be programmed to improve certain types of mental health outcomes or to give, you know, positive feedback to the individual. So yes, just engagement in general is positive. But I think video games are special and unique in the fact that they can be programmed to give specific types of feedback that we'd be looking for.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there. And let me go over a couple of recent studies looking at different aspects of it. First, let me address the question of are just playing video games harmful? And there's actually, we're talking about two things kind of at the same time here. One is, are they helpful or harmful to neurological function, which is more what you're talking about with rehab, versus harmful or helpful to mental health, just like depression, anxiety, compulsive behavior, things like that.
Right. Well, I would think if you're struggling with compulsive behaviors, that might be a special category.
Yeah. So there is a there is a video game addiction thing that exists, but we're not really talking about that. We'll put that aside. Right. There was a recent study where they just looked at aggressive video game, like playing aggressive video games, and does that predict a later risk, a higher risk of anxiety, depression, or aggressive behavior? And the answer is no. There's no real correlation there. And that pretty much corresponds to, I think, the bulk of the literature on this topic. Video games are not to blame for violent or aggressive behavior.
And if anything, for some people, they offer an outlet.
Yeah, exactly.
Of a pre-existing experience.
So interestingly, a lot of the research now has shifted towards, you know, away from proving over and over again that they're not harmful, basically, to, well, can they be leveraged as a benefit? And so there's a couple of different, well, there's a recent review of looking at mitigating the symptoms of depression and anxiety using commercial video games. So these are not video games that were especially designed for this purpose. These are off-the-shelf commercial video games that anybody would play for entertainment and fun. Mm-hmm. This is a narrative review. They were just sort of they weren't doing any kind of statistical analysis. They were just reviewing all the studies that are out there. And their conclusion, you know, was that, yeah, there's actually a lot of evidence for benefit in terms of mitigating symptoms of both anxiety and depression in video games, I mean, just off the shelf, just commercial video games. And so they brought up a number of potential benefits. One is that a lot of people have access to video games. I know we might think of that as sort of a first world kind of thing, but they estimated that like almost 3 billion people in the world have access to video games.
That's wow.
And so it's not everybody, but it's not just not just like wealthy Westerners. It's actually pretty.
Because you can also play them on your phone, and most people in the world have access, or many people,
exactly.
A surprising number of people have access to smartphones.
So they're pretty accessible. There's a pretty low bar there. It's certainly cheaper than a therapist. They're very accessible. Some of them can get pretty expensive, but usually it's only a one-time expense. There's a lot of free games out there, first of all, but even the ones that cost some money, it's usually just a one-time expense. And yeah, there's a lot of evidence that it does help people sort of regulate their emotions, helps them to be more calm. It does, you know, help them, you know, divert their attention from just ruminating over depressive ideation or distract them from their anxiety. And it actually
can't. A reason to get up in the morning, honestly.
Absolutely.
Sometimes something that simple.
So overall, they found it to be very effective. But I also found a study that looked specifically at a video game that was created as a treatment for anxiety and depression. And I don't know if you've ever seen this, Kara. It's called Rethink.
Oh, yeah, I have. Yeah, okay. That's used in rehab. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the name of the video game. Mm-hmm. I couldn't play the video game itself, but I saw a trailer that walks you through the game. So but essentially, like, it's different levels. So, like, you have to missions, and you have to pass the level to go on to the next one. Like, in the first level, your mission is to correctly identify the emotional state of the characters on the screen, right? Are they happy? Are they sad? Are they anxious or whatever? That's it. That's your mission. And then it's all animated. So it's pretty low budget, but it's an animated video game. Then, like, the next level, you would progress to choosing what your emotional response to different situations, and then you have to choose the correct emotional response in order to pass that level. So it basically walks you through teaching people, like, how to identify emotions, what emotions are an appropriate response in different situations, and then also...
Yeah, so it's like psychoeducation.
Yeah, it's basically, like, they likened it to cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, but just sort of automated in a video game. And apparently the evidence shows that it's quite effective, which is not surprising. And, you know, this got a lot of attention over the pandemic year because, you know, people were looking for other options because obviously a lot of people couldn't go to their therapist. This is why online therapy got a huge boost over the last year. But this was also something else that got a huge boost in terms of interest and use. And again, the evidence shows that it actually is fairly effective, you know, which got me thinking about. So now we have evidence that, like, a program designed to basically automate CBT through a video game is effective, and just off-the-shelf video games are actually could be beneficial. And there really isn't any evidence of harm. Again, we're putting aside, like, the addiction component.
Yeah.
It seems to me that we're really not anywhere close to leveraging the potential of video games in terms of mental health treatment.
I agree.
Yeah.
And we have there's so much potential.
Yeah, there's a lot of potential there. I mean, even just putting a little bit more budget behind like the Rethink kind of game, but also, because think about it, and you know, We video games are optimized for learning a lot of things, right? It's an engaging, immediate feedback kind of interaction. You develop a skill, like the carrot is always right out in front of you, and then it keeps that, you know, keeps dragging you along. As soon as you master one level, you go to the next level, which gets a little bit harder. It's kind of optimized for learning.
And you can develop feedback as you go.
Yeah.
And like, there's this, you know, kind of choose your own adventure component to video games that's really important for patient care. And I think CBT is also optimized for this, because CBT, it's the most research form of psychotherapy by far, and it's the most manualized form of psychotherapy. You know, the concepts in CBT are pretty rigorous and rigid, and there are a lot of like workbooks that have been utilized, and a lot of times you can train people to offer these CBT interventions that aren't psychologists, for example. And so I think it's sort of like we're taking the low-hanging fruit of video games and the low-hanging fruit of CBT, and at the very least we should be able to democratize very basic level cognitive behavioral intervention for anxiety and depression and get people the low level help that they need. And then if they need further psychotherapy, further medication intervention, you know, obviously to have those kinds of tools available to them is important. But think about how many people who just fall through the cracks if they could access this.
And also, it could also be used, you know, as a hybrid approach. You know, even if you have
mark your cards,
if resources are not a limiting factor, it still might be better to like meet with your therapist once a month instead of once a week, and then in between you have your homework to do, which is essentially, you know, could include leveling up on your video on the video game.
Already, I do this with a lot of my patients, the ones who have specific diagnoses for which a manualized treatment is beneficial and that are like really high functioning. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're going to do this workbook. And when we meet, we're going to discuss some of the things that came up during those exercises. It's like, it helps you to make your time really effective and meaningful, but it also gives somebody the kind of self, you know, motivation. But workbooks suck. Mm-hmm. Like, video games are so much more fun than workbooks.
Totally. I think they're more effective too. I remember even going back to high school.
It could be.
I learned like chemical formulas, like nomenclature on a video game that was designed to teach it. And it was, I just thought, wow, I learned this so quickly because the feedback is immediate and it was actually kind of fun. It's also very good for managing your attention. And still, I'm disappointed that I don't think the video game format has been leveraged as much as it should be just for learning in general. You know, we had like the online learning experiment over the last year was mostly a disaster. And not because online learning is bad, but because with the infrastructure for it was not there. And they tried to do in-person learning on Zoom, and that didn't work. The infrastructure for remote or online learning did not exist. And so my fear is that post-pandemic, There's a huge, get kids back in the classroom, get them back in the classroom. I agree with that. We need to get kids back in the classroom, but I hope it doesn't sour a generation on the potential for this kind of learning just because it failed, because we weren't ready for it, not because it's conceptually.
I agree too, because, and it's not like some of this stuff is even new. Like, I remember when I was teaching anatomy and physiology lab back in like 2005, and we had gamification of our A&P laboratory. Like, we would do wet lab, but then on the days when we weren't doing wet lab, there were these interactive computer games that the students would play to like learn the nerves or to learn the blood vessels.
Totally.
And it was so much better than just like looking at pictures or me standing up there lecturing.
Yeah, you know, there's definitely some of it out there, and what is out there I think works really well. Just not as much as there should be now.
Yeah, I would have been. What's just the not limiting factor?
It's
expensive.
Resources.
Is it expensive?
Yeah.
So there's no profit to be made, therefore no impetus for these designers.
No, I mean, I'm sure there is a profit to be made, but I think it's probably not just too expensive. And we know that we don't fund our education system, public education system, well in this country at all. But also, there's just a lot of bureaucratic red tape,
mm-hmm.
right? There,
but we can't find existing product out there and approve it for these purposes?
I mean, existing product does exist. And so the question is, why in certain platforms at certain schools are they not utilizing it?
Right.
Maybe they don't know about it. Maybe they can't afford it. Maybe there is an old school mentality that our teachers aren't actually teaching if they're putting kids in front of a video game. There's probably a lot of psychological, economic, and just political, and generational barriers to this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm. But also, like, it doesn't have to be high end. The chemistry game I'm telling you about, that was in the 1970s, and it was fine.
Basically sophisticated version of Pong.
It was all texted, but that's okay. That wasn't the issue. It was just that whoever did it knew what they were doing. You know. Anyway.
Yeah. The A&P thing was really low tech, but it was fun for the students. They were like, oh, kick ass. I get to sit in front of the computer during lab today.
Right. I remember that. I remember being psyched that there was some type of video game element with school, and it really enhanced the experience and made my interest quadruple. Oh, yeah. So you know what I find funny, Steve? Like, this whole thing about whether or not video games are safe, like, to the vast majority of gamers, we already know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
There's a fear-based element that people were being driven by, like, oh, it's bad. It's going to introduce weird thoughts into kids' heads, whatever. Like, just like bad music. Remember the whole labeling thing in the 80s?
Oh, it's like satanic panic all over again.
It's a video game panic, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, totally.
Oh, gosh.
All right, Bob, I've been hearing a lot of news recently about the formation of the Milky Way galaxy. I don't think this is just one news item, but you're going to tell us about part of
it. Yeah, I haven't heard anything about that.
All right, so researchers have recently used a new stellar technique to confirm the timing when our Milky Way galaxy essentially became the Milky Way galaxy billions of years ago. This was published in the journal Nature Astronomy. And so I want to know, I'll start with a question. What's everyone's favorite galaxy? Quick.
Oh, Andromeda. M31? See it through.
I'm partial to the Milky Way. It's where I keep all my stuff.
Yeah, I like Betelgeuse.
That's a star.
I know. I'm just messing with
Andromeda. All
right. Well, yeah, it's got to be the Milky Way, or at least the top three, right? Because we do live here. But there are scientists that look at the history and development of galaxies, and it is the most epic job title I've ever heard: galactic archaeologist.
Woo! That's cool.
Is that awesome? So, what do you do, Bob? I'm a galactic archaeologist. Oh my god. So they basically reconstruct the past events. They look at the history of a galaxy and to put together, you know, what happened to it. And so this is what was happened for this news item. And this also includes galaxy mergers. Galaxies merge all the time. And that's going to be an important part, something that a galactic archaeologist is going to have to look into. And the most important one apparently happened 10 billion years ago. Now, the Milky Way swallowed, you know, multiple different, you know, smaller galaxies in the past that we found evidence for. This one looks like it was the most important. So imagine 10 billion years ago, you've got a progenitor galaxy and you have this satellite galaxy in orbit around each other. Now, the progenitor is four times more massive than the smaller one, and it's more metal rich. Now, I tried to find out the name of the progenitor galaxy. No name.
Make
I couldn't
up.
Find any name, and I thought that was really sad. So, Jay, I'm naming it Frank. So our progenitor galaxy was Frank.
That'll take off.
Yes. Oh, it absolutely will. Now, the satellite galaxy was called, they gave it a name. It's called Gaia Enceladus. Or it has another name that I'm going to use, and this is a legit name. It's called Gaia Sausage. Gaia
what?
Sausage. And
no,
that's because... Yes, it is. It absolutely is. And that's because if you look at the data from the Gaia mission, the data looks like an elongated sausage. So that name stuck.
Creative.
A lot of things look like sausage. Why do they have to pick sausage?
Well, you know, they could have picked a far worse name.
I think Gaia Phallia is better than Gaia sausage, to be fair.
Gaia Phallia.
I think it's a little...
Yeah.
It's more lovely.
I like that. Okay, Gaia Phallia it is. Gaia Phallia was a dwarf galaxy, slightly more massive than the small Magellanic Cloud. And this is a quote from Josefina Montalban,
who led the project, she said, the merging event with Gaia Enceladus is thought to be one of the most important in the Milky Way's history, shaping how we observe it today. She's right, obviously, because she's a scientist and she knows what she's talking about. But what happened was that this merger added a lot of real estate. They calculate at least 8 globular clusters, along with 50 billion solar masses of stars, gas, and dark matter. So this was a huge, bam, here you go, bolus of matter and energy for the for Frank. But to do that, though, to actually know all this stuff, they had to employ a new technique called astroseismology. I hadn't heard of this before. It's not astroseismology. It's astero, A-S-T-E-R-O. I'm sure they got a good reason for that. So what astroseismology does is it studies stellar interiors. It can examine the oscillations within stars, the sound waves that move, you know, that bounce around back and forth on the inside. And with it, you can find out a lot of stuff about the star. They combine that technique with spectroscopy to see what elements are in the star as well. So in their study, they looked at 100 old red giant stars, 100 of them. And they found out that a bunch of them were alien stars that came from Gaia sausage or Gaia Thalia, which isn't real, but I like it. Now, in general, these Gaia Thalia stars, were younger, a little bit younger, and they have different orbits than stars that were from Frank. Now, if you want to look at the Milky Way now, if you look at it now, so what can you see today? That, you know, that was the impact. What were the ramifications of this huge merger? So if you look at a lot of the stars near the core of the Milky Way, they came from the original progenitor, Frank. But if you look at, if you look at the diffuse halo of stars around the galaxy, around the Milky Way, those are from Gaia Thalia. And the stars in general, you could say generally that the stars have different trajectories and also the merger of these two galaxies thickened the Milky Way's disk. And I think that's because of all the gas that came crashing together. Because, you know, during a galactic merger, the stars don't hit. It's all about the gas. It's all about the gas
sounds kind of so merging. Sounds so dirty. Like, I've got right. So much gas, my disk is thickening.
Oh, wow. I didn't think of that at all. But all that gas crashing together, of course, causes stellar nurseries to pop up and star
births. That happens in my bedroom every night. Don't worry.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, boy.
So what's going to happen in the future? In the future, they're going to look at a lot more stars. They're going to measure in them using, astroseismology and spectroscopy and get even more detailed information so that they can fine tune the history and evolution of the Milky Way. But remember, the mergers are not done. I mean, we've got a lot more interesting mergers coming up. In a few million years, we're going to merge with the Large and Small Magellanic Cloud.
Yeah. That's going to mark your calendar. Yep.
That's going to be a fun
time.
We saw them. I already marked it.
We've seen them in Australia. Eyes.
They were fantastic.
Seeing them
naked eye for the first time was, you know, a religious experience. But then after that is the big one. What's the really big
Andromeda merger that's coming?
That's going to be in about a billion years. And I think it's going to be like a double tap. I think we're going to merge and then separate and then come back and for the final gathering. And that's going to change a lot of stuff. That's going to lead to massive star formation because even in a billion years, there's going to be plenty of gas left. So there's going to be massive star formation. But the downside, the negative part of this is that our beautiful barred spiral galaxy is going to become elliptical. It's going to become rounder. It's not going to have any disk or arms because that's essentially what happens when you have two big galaxies of similar mass merging. Ellipticals are fine, but they're not beautiful like barred spirals like the Milky Way. So that's kind of I'm not looking forward to seeing that happen. Now, the name of the, what do you guys think of this? I've found two names for the merger of Milky Way and Andromeda. I found Milkometa.
Milk of Magnesia.
I know.
Right. Or I've seen Milkdromeda, which is better. Right? Milkdromeda is better than Milkometa.
I think they both suck. We need to come up with a brand new
Andromaway.
Awesome
hello.
Andromaway.
that's all right.
Andromaway.
Of those three choices.
Andromeda should get top billing because it is, you know, more massive than we are. But then after that, how about that? After that merger, guys, what's the next, you know, how's it going to all end up?
The rest of the galaxies in our supercluster?
No, not in our supercluster. We're not really locally bound like that. It would be the local group of galaxies.
The local group. Dwarf galaxies.
The 50 galaxies that are all like, like one gravitationally bound unit. So they're all going to merge in the far distant future. And then that's going to be it. That's it. Wow. There'll be nothing to merge with because the closest galaxy will be too far away to ever merge with. And that's going to be our entire universe at that time.
By the way, Kara, you mentioned how easy it is to misinterpret all these phrases in a dirty way. So we were watching, my wife and my daughter and I were watching Forge and Fire, right? And I was watching it. It was just on in the background for them. And our daughter, who's a senior in high school, is like giggling to herself constantly. And so if she were watching a video and giggling, I wouldn't even notice. But like, what the hell is so funny? You're just like giggling to yourself over here. She was laughing at all of the sexual innuendo in the show Forged with Fire, which of course, it only mildly occurred to me when watching it, but like once you put that in your head, everything they say is sexual
innuendo. Give me an example.
So it's all about Forged. So, of course you have to make your billet has to be long and hard.
Oh, right.
And
it's all about making swords.
Getting hot in here.
Swords are essentially penises. Come on.
Yes, they are. They're pain penises. They're murder penises.
That fits really nice in my hand. I can get a really good grip on that.
I love stroking that tang.
Yeah. You have to go to the grinder and grind away. Like, he's just really grinding away there.
Grinder.
It never gets old.
Good stuff.
Oh, and now I can't.
Can't watch
lots of
done.
Thrusting.
Contaminated.
They mentioned thrusting a lot.
Yep. You can't unhear it.
I know. All right, Evan, finish off the news items with dowsing again. More
Can
dowsing.
You believe it? Some things just never go away. Oh, it's a thing. I'm reading the Connecticut Post, which is Connecticut's, we're in Connecticut except for Kara, Connecticut's largest newspaper, online and whatnot. There it is, article from a few weeks ago. Stanford man tracks down fossils, time capsules, and more through dowsing.
Through accident.
It's like, come on. I can't help but be reminded, one of Perry's first articles for the Connecticut Skeptics Society. This is back in 1996. It was called
Way Back
Dowsing in Connecticut. You guys must remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Burned into my brain practically. So every time I hear the word dowsing in Connecticut, that's it. It's Perry's piece. And he wrote specifically about, he went to speak with some people at the Connecticut chapter of the American Society of Dowsers. I'll never forget this. And Jay, you might remember this. At one point, he tried to reach someone there, got on the phone with someone, explained that he was from the Connecticut Skeptic Society, and Perry went like this. He held the phone. When he was explaining it to me, he held his hand up, doing the classic phone in the ear, right, that we talked about earlier with the extended thumb and pinky. And he says, yeah, it's Perry of the Angelus Connecticut Skeptics. And the guy on the other side said, I don't have to prove nothing to you guys.
Remember that? I totally remember that.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, we would crack up so often about that. So, God, what a great memory. So here we are 25 years later, and it's still being, pseudosciences, they just don't vanish. All right. So what's this guy? What the heck? His name is, last name is Bull, of all things. It's totally appropriate. Leroy Bull. I kid you not, that's his name. Connecticut dowser. He's been dowsing since age 12. He's 77 now.
Oh, so he's practiced in his bullshit.
Oh, yes, for 60-plus years.
Evan, is this the same guy that Perry spoke to?
Who knows? I mean, it's entirely
still
possible.
Still doing it. Yeah.
Entirely possible. He was taught by his grandfather when he was living in New York. He was a dairy farmer, and he doused for water, and he showed basically the whole family how it worked. And he said, this guy, Leroy Bull, said, his first experience that he was given the willow sticks, you're given your two sticks, and taught how to do it. And he said, boy, these sticks snapped, my sticks snapped down so fast that it surprised me. And that's a typical kind of story you get with dowsers about the power, how the sticks fly out of their hands because it's so incredible and, just overwhelming. You can't even hold on to the dowsing rods. Yeah. All right. Well, this guy, he was a former federal food inspector for what that's worth. And he claims he has found about 3,200 wells on 4 different continents. So he flies around the world. I imagine people pay him to go. He says his accuracy rate is about 95%.
Oh, that's good.
But for the 5% that he misses, it has to do with, rock formations. Rocks get in the way. But if those pesky rocks weren't there, this guy would have 100% success. Right. But he has also explained that certainly, you know, while he douses for wells and things, there's plenty of other things you can douse for, which he has learned over the years, including dinosaur bones or lost pets or lost engagement rings.
Wait, look lost at the bones. Pets?
Lost pets. Yes.
So
lost
pets.
Don't you douse for things that are underground?
Yes.
You could douse anything, Carrie. You could douse a map. Anything. You could douse a map.
Yeah, you go to the map.
But like missing pets seems like you could just look with their eyes.
Do I need to give people a visual example of what dowsing is?
I think so.
My dowsing rod's here, and I'll talk about it. I take two paper clips, and I turn them into these L-shaped little rods, and I put them in my thumb between my thumbs and my forefingers, and I rotate them. And essentially, when they cross like that, there you go. I found something, whatever it was I was looking for, my soda can or whatever I'm dowsing for. So it's crazy. He's been again, flown all over the world. He says he's been to Japan 12 times, and they hired him to find time capsules buried by grade school kids, you know, whatever, 50 years ago, 75 years ago. So 95% success, he claims.
Wait, Ev. There's like what? There's a lot of people that bury time capsules and they lost them.
Weren't you part of a school or something that buried a time capsule in, you know, your sixth grade class or something?
Yeah, I
think I did it at some point. You're not supposed to lose track of it. That's
so that they go, yeah, we buried it around here somewhere.
right. Yeah. So for whatever reason,
what's happening?
Remember. And he'll find it. But, you know, who the heck really knows what's going on? It certainly isn't any sort of special power that he's got. You know, there's nothing physical, you know, there's nothing physical other than the ideomotor effect, you know, the subtle move, very subtle, hard to detect movements of, say, your thumbs and forefingers, which move things around, and you read into that, that something significant is happening. But it's, you know, science says otherwise. He says the equipment is just a means to an end. I love this quote. A knife, fork, and spoon are used to propel food to your face. The equipment is just to show that you've found the energy. So, you know, yeah, that's what he said. Basically, he's making a bad analogy or allegory there.
Yeah.
But is he saying that he senses the energy?
Oh, yes. Yep. It's a combination of both. There's energy to be detected, but also the physical skill, you see. It's a combination of actual dexterity plus the energy that he's able to magically detect.
Right. But they could never demonstrate any ability whatsoever under the slightest controlled conditions.
That's right. Control it, and magically it all goes away.
Where is this guy located?
He's in Stamford.
We should take him down. I mean, we should interview him.
Sure, we'll just call him up and we'll see what if he gives us the parry answer. I don't have to prove nothing to you guys.
So I would totally
prove nothing to nobody
tonight.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, dowsing will never go away.
Never go away. Papers will continue to report on it too.
Yeah, Steve, before we move on, I just have a few things I want to say to people.
Sure.
First, I'd like to tell the five of you or the four of you, I love you.
Thank you.
Here's a
mild moment of uncomfortableness.
Yeah.
And then I will continue.
Love you too, bro.
Thanks.
I love you, man.
All right, so, Jay, you guys know the list of things that we have going on. We have a ton of live shows coming up. Well, not a ton, but we have several. And we're going to be at Dragon Con. We're doing a live show, live podcast recording, very similar to this. At Dragon Con, we are going to be doing an extravaganza in Atlanta. So you can get all the information on our website. We also have two live shows and a extravaganza in Denver in November. You can, again, go to skepticsguide.org/events to see the dates on that.
All right. Thanks, Jay. All right, guys, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake-a-rooney. There's a theme this week, and the theme is biggest. These are all things that are the biggest. Okay?
Bigly,
yep. Here we go. They're all huge. Here we go.
Huge.
Item number one.
Cat with a capital Y.
Item number one. The largest single computer ever built was in China in 1972, the Tianhe 1, which occupied almost an acre of land. Item number two, astronomers have identified the largest rotating structures in the universe, filaments of galaxy clusters hundreds of millions of light years across. And number three, paleontologists have discovered a new species of the largest mammal genus to have ever walked the land, the giant rhino Paraceratherium. Let's start with Kara.
This is rough. I feel like I've read multiple news items related to multiple things you've said, but didn't actually read them, just saw the headlines, which makes me like no less than if I had read them. Who knows if that's the largest computer? I have no idea. An acre? I mean, whatever, though. What if they just added a bunch of crap to it? And I'm assuming, oh, yeah, it says single computer. So we're not talking about, like, using the processing power of computers.
Not a bank of computers.
Yeah, it was one computer. Yep.
Okay. And then we've got the big old galaxy filaments. They rotate hundreds of millions of light years across. I don't know, that sounds big. So basically what you're saying is we don't really know, or we're not going to discuss what they physically are, but we're considering them a single entity, like a structure, because they themselves are rotating in a pattern.
Correct.
Okay. And then
the whole thing could be said to be rotating. Yeah.
Exactly. So even if it's made up of a bajillion little things, it's acting like, I'm going to say it's like a swarm. It's more like a murmuration.
Mm-hmm.
A cosmic murmuration. I'm going to call that one science. And then the large rhino. I feel like this might be a thing, but I don't know if it's the largest. This is the thing that's throwing me off. I don't know if any of these things are the largest, but I'll say sure. Big ass rhino. Why not? So I'm going to say the fiction is the computer.
Okay, Jay.
Yeah, just to keep it nice and short, I'm going to agree with Kara. Basing my decision to pick the computer one as the fake. One, because at this point in my life, there is no way I wouldn't have heard of, you know, this computer if it existed back in 1972. And number two, like, I'm not even that impressed with 1 acre. It isn't really that big of a piece of land if you think about, like, how as far as buildings go, like especially government-style buildings that, you know, or scientific buildings, 1 acre is nothing. So I'm not impressed, and I am not going to be fooled, Steve. That one is the fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Yeah, I'm kind of in agreement with everyone else. That one is going to be the fiction. Did we talk once about a computer taking up the size of a building in Philadelphia something? Or was it our show in Philadelphia when that came? I have some recollection of Philadelphia somehow being tied into that. Yeah, a single computer, an acre. Maybe I'll take the opposite tact of Jay on this, thinking, you know, an acre, you know, for one thing like a computer, I don't think is insignificant, but I just have a feeling that that's not the biggest. It's either not that big or something was much bigger than it, but in either case, I think that one's fiction.
All right. And Bob,
start from number three. So the rhino, the biggest mammal rhino. Yeah. That kind of makes sense. I know that there were some huge, huge rhinos in the past. And, so I think that could potentially be the biggest mammal. The second one, the filament, that's pretty amazing. Hundreds of millions of light years across. That's some new science. I can't imagine that, you know, how that whole structure would rotate. But I mean, I wouldn't be shocked. The one that's surprising to me is I'm gonna agree with me and say that the Tiane one, I'm gonna say that one's fiction. That doesn't sound right. I mean, they had a Tiane supercomputer that I think was number one in the world, but it wasn't back in 72. That was only like, what, 10, 12 years ago, or even sooner. But maybe it was Tiane 20. I forget the number. But that doesn't sound right. That sounds either – something about that one is rubbing me the wrong way. I know that the computers were big back in the day, but they didn't really have to deal with cooling as much as they're dealing with cooling now. And they weren't really glomming together so many, like, you know, graphical, you know, GPUs and all that stuff back then. But there wasn't a lot of, you know, shrinking going on back then either. I don't know. I'm just going to say that one's fiction.
Okay, so we polled our live audience, and 78% of them agree with the rogues that the computer one is the fiction. 11% think that the astronomy one is the fiction, and 13% think that the giant rhino is the fiction. So about, you know, three-quarters of the audience agree with you guys. So let's take these in reverse order, since you all agree with the first one. We'll start with number three. Paleontologists have discovered a new species of the largest mammal genus to have ever walked the land, the giant rhino Paraceratherium. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Huge.
That one is science. And earlier in the show, somebody put this news item in the chat. And I had to make it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you would have recognized the answer from that. Yeah, here, like, you know, much bigger than an elephant. Like, the thing was absolutely ginormous. In the
I see is a blank screen.
Late Oligocene. So that's a genus, right? So they found a new species of that genus. This also helps them understand how it spread out throughout Asia, because of where they found it.
That thing is horrifying.
Yeah, but the thing itself is big.
Yeah.
All right.
Muscly.
Let's go back to number two. Astronomers have identified the largest rotating structures in the universe, filaments of galaxy clusters hundreds of millions of light years across. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is...
Say it.
Science.
Yeah, baby.
Science. Good job, everyone. Yeah, so there is a, what do you call it, the cosmic web, right? There's
The Tholian web.
If you look at the entire universe, right, there's a structure to the universe.
Like a sponge shape.
Yeah, it's like a web of these giant filaments where one filament contains many galaxy clusters. If you were like outside looking at a filament, each galaxy would just be a speck inside of it.
Yeah, like a star, actually.
Yeah, that's how big these structures are. And so the recent observations showed that these filaments, or at least they'd be able to show that one of these filaments was the whole thing is rotating. So that's the biggest rotating structure ever observed in the universe. And it shows that they could be bound, I guess, gravitationally in such a way that, you know, that angular momentum can exist on that scale, which is new. That is extremely large.
Yes. I think they're having trouble explaining it.
Yeah.
It's not obvious. Yeah. Like, oh yeah.
It's definitely pushing the limits. All of this means that the largest single computer ever built was in China in 1972, the Tianhe-1, which occupied almost an acre of land, is the fiction. Bob, you're correct. I just stole the name of Tianhe-1 from the supercomputer. I thought maybe you might like recognize the name, but lose track of the number. Whatever.
I did not. Well, okay. I knew when it was out, and it was not out in the 70s, man. This was like recently.
That wasn't a big computer. That was a supercomputer. We're talking big, physically volume big. So what do you guys think was the biggest supercomputer?
I gathered that. Computer?
I would say three times that size, at least.
So this was the Sage computer built by IBM in 1957.
Sure.
Which included 20 components, each of which was a building that was like a cube with an acre in area.
So it's 20 acres?
Yeah, basically.
Wow.
And
it now it's in your cell phone.
Each one contained 60,000 vacuum tubes, 175,000 diodes, and 13,000 of those newfangled transistors. All to generate.
And what was the processing power?
256 kilobytes of magnetic core RAM.
Wow. Damn, man.
Wow.
It's like a digital watch.
Now, what was this built for? What was this massive computer built for?
In the 50s?
It was 57.
Was it computation on
rocket trajectories?
It had to be arms.
Cold
yeah.
War.
Something.
Rocket trajectories.
Total Cold War. Not rocket trajectories. Yeah. This was our missile defense system. This was basically our... But it was analyzing all of the, you know, the radar to keep track of anything flying. So this was to detect, like, the first detection of, like, the Soviets launching an attack on the United States or whatever.
It was the big board.
Yeah, the big board. Yeah. So they actually used, it was the first use of cathode ray tube monitors, CRTs. And they actually had a light gun that they could use to, like, draw on it. It was in operation from... It was from 1961 to 1972, so 21 years. During that time, it did not actually detect a single incursion.
it's a very helpful machine.
It
seemed to be right.
It slept well at night.
It was, but maybe there would have been if we didn't have that defense. Who knows? The article I was reading about it said, however, I'm sorry, it was 1963. And 1984 were the dates, 1963 to 1984.
84.
With thousands of people all over North America constantly monitoring the data from this computer. They say, however, that just the IBM building this machine, you know, had an effect. You know, this it's possible that this, you know,
a deterrent.
It certainly made, no, in terms of just computer technology, that it hastened the internet and air traffic control systems, and also was a huge part of IBM's later success. And of course, they had a big role to play in the personal computer. So the project itself may have really ushered in or helped usher in the later computer age.
Well, that puts to shame the fact that I still have a 3.5-inch floppy hanging around somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
One of those buildings are yeah. still standing. That's the winner.
That sounded extra dirty.
All right.
Kara, what the hell is happening today?
Right out of the gutter, girl.
Yeah, right?
I just can't.
Hey, it's Friday. You know what I mean? What can
I
tell
you? It doesn't change the fact that I got a 3.5-inch floppy over here.
I know, man.
Come on.
3.5-inch floppy on my hard drive.
I hope you're a grower.
So we're going to take a few questions from our live audience. All right, so the first question is our feelings about the HBO documentary, The Crime of the Century, which is about the recent opioid scandal.
I mean, don't get me wrong, it shows some pretty disgusting like industry problems and and court documents, and you know, it's well researched, but basically they never really spend a lot of time on how beneficial pain medications can be for the patients who need them. So it's very heavily anti-opiates and addictiveness of opiates. And it doesn't show a very important side of the story, which is that some people don't become addicted to drugs. So it just feels very like, and I think it was an Alex Gibney doc. And I don't know, I take issues with a lot of Alex Gibney's docs. So just watch it with, you know, with a grain of salt.
Yeah, it's a very nuanced topic. And if you just like marshal all of the one-sided points and ignore the fact that there are people whose lives are just being in excruciating pain, and this is the only thing that could help them, you know, exist. You have to balance that against, you know, the risk. It's all risk versus benefit. If you just say, here's all the risk and just ignore the benefit, then it gets, yeah, it's one-sided.
Yeah, and I wish they would have, because the thing is, that is a given in the doc, but they just don't spend any time on it. So part of one of the things that they really dig deep into, which is illuminating at best, or at least, is that these drugs were originally FDA approved to relieve pain in metastatic cancer patients. And then they were often prescribed like after somebody has back surgery, or they were starting to be utilized a lot in completely off-label situations. And that's where a lot of the problems began. So that was an interesting kind of component, but I don't know, grain of salt. I mean, I'm not saying that anything in the doc seemed blatantly untrue. It just seemed that there was a definite kind of narrative to the documentary that is an important one, but also one that does ignore the plight of many, many people who require important pain medications and who sadly, I've seen this happen so many times, I can't tell you, that I'll have metastatic cancer patients who are dying of their disease and they won't want to take meds because they're afraid that they're going to be addicted to them.
That is so
It's very common.
Wow.
Very common. And it's a big problem for palliative care doctors that they have to really do a lot of education around these drugs, because the media narrative around opiates is basically that they're evil.
Yeah.
Like there's right. a it's very bad, negative spin to opiates in the media.
Yeah. If you abuse anything incorrectly, it's
but even
it's
still,
negative.
It's not evil, you know.
Well, right.
I mean?
Like, you're right. Yeah, not evil.
No, I mean, I was recently in this conversation with somebody who was like, saw the documentary and then was trying to throw it in my face about how evil everything is. Oh, but it was like the drugs aren't the problem. I mean, they're limiting. There's a limiting factor to opiates because they are addictive. Absolutely, that's an unfortunate aspect to this medication. But I said the drugs work as they're supposed to. The problem was how they were marketed by yes. certain companies, and that too many physicians bought into that marketing and they should have known better. But it's also, it's very hard because I've been there, and I don't care, I don't, you've probably been there. When you have a patient sitting across from your desk crying in agony, begging you to help them live their life, that's, if you haven't been in that situation, you know, you don't know the risk benefit, you know, what's going on here. If you're just looking at it from the outside, kibitzing from the sidelines about, oh, if you're, you know, it's evil to use these drugs, you don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. You have to look at both sides of the equation, or you have to be really heartless to not be at least motivated to do everything you can for that patient. But this has been going on for my entire medical career. This debate. Right. This is nothing new.
And I think
new.
We scapegoat the physicians oftentimes. I do think one thing that the documentary does well is it shows how nefarious, exactly as you said, the marketing mm-hmm. was and the drug sales, just the push. And
the big problem was that there were red flags that the pills were being prescribed inappropriately and mm-hmm. they were ignored. Right.
Absolutely.
So suddenly 10 times the opiates are being sold in this community. Oh, nothing to see here. That was the problem. Yeah. It's like clearly there's abuse going on. Yeah.
For patients that had no business having access to fentanyl.
Yeah. So like in Connecticut, the number one street drug is prescription opiates. Mm-hmm. That's the number. Yeah. So, we absolutely have to very carefully monitor for what's happening with our prescriptions at multiple levels, not just the physicians, but the pharmacy and the DEA and the state. And they do, but this system broke down, and which was unfortunate.
And we clearly don't have as robust a system to support people who are struggling with addiction.
Yes.
Once that does occur, mm-hmm. Because we use non-evidence-based approaches for addiction treatment and management. People are still weirdly resistant to Narcan. People are still, nobody should have an opiate prescription without a Narcan prescription, or a heavy, like a fentanyl prescription without a Narcan prescription. But there's still a very puritanical view on drugs in this country, where we see, that needle exchange programs, for example, are... there's pressure not to allow for needle exchange programs when we know they work. Like, it's not evidence-based. It's like based on weird moral judgments. And so, it's a complicated issue. And I do think the doc is informative. I would, I would recommend watching it, but just keep in mind that there is a very important medical side of the story.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that they gave enough. I get it. That wasn't the point of the doc. The point of the doc was to be like, look what Purdue Pharma did. And it's holy crap, what they did was not okay.
But I have experienced people who saw the documentary and came away with a very distorted view of the whole issue. So that, in my mind, was not a good job. All right. Is there another question? Yeah. All right. So the question is, Bob, which type of Gen 4 reactor do you hope succeeds? Is that it?
I just want something to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. I've been waiting so long for any of these things to pan out.
Well, Gen 4 is that's the latest design of fission reactor. So it could be referring to that. And there's about five or six of them. And they're all much better than the current, the Gen 3 fission.
Yeah. I'm not too up on the fission ones. I've been tracking the fusion ones. I know that ITER's looking really good. Have you guys seen in the news that they're taking the magnet? This magnet that could literally pick up an aircraft carrier. They're sending it to France.
Whoa,
yeah.
Cool.
And now, of course, that would never work because it's structural integrity. They're sending it on a slow boat to France for their ITER fusion reactor setup. I've been tracking that. So fission, if that's a fission, fourth gen fission, I haven't been tracking that. I'm not sure what the latest stuff is with fission.
I read just today, Bob, that a Canadian company, General Fusion, is planning on building a prototype plant in the UK, and that Jeff Bezos is going to be financing part of it.
Really?
Great.
But this is not going to be a fusion reactor that produces electricity for the grid. This is just a prototype.
Right.
But the ITER, the ITER one, that is will eventually be actually able to produce electricity for the grid, if it all works out.
If it works out, I'm really excited about what the MIT is working on, because they're working on the latest generation of magnetic field generation to confine the plasma. That I think might have an even better chance because I think ITER is set on specific technology that really would be difficult to upgrade, whereas MIT is using the latest stuff. But I don't care. I just want one of them to succeed. And fission is kind of I just haven't been as interested as I used to be.
Yeah, but for the rest of this century, fission is going to be critical.
Right. You have to have it.
Yeah.
What do you say, Steve? 30% of our
future.
It should be. So it, my, you know, from what my reading, probably at the end of the day, we're going to need 20 to 30% base load. And we'd rather have that be nuclear than
because it's fossil fuels. Otherwise,
It's going to be fossil fuel.
Right, right. And, it's great though to see a lot more people coming around. I don't think we're where we need to be yet, but you know, a lot of these environmentalists are saying, you know, there are some of them. I haven't been taking a deep dive on it, but Steve, maybe you would know. A lot of them are saying, this is needed now.
Well, I was paying very close attention to the what the Biden administration had to say about it. And so during the campaign, like if you look at his campaign websites and all that stuff, it was just no mention of nuclear.
Not good.
But earlier this year, they were talking about everything's on the table, including nuclear. So that's at least one step up from like it not existing. You know, if they're considering it, that's a good thing. Has Jay picked any pandemic project segments for Nexus yet? Jay, tell us, give us an update on that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm not going to give any details, but I will. I'll give one detail. So one of the pandemic projects is going to be Flew LeBorg. Mm-hmm. Anybody know who he is?
Oh, yeah.
No.
He is a hilarious German comic. Oh,
yeah, okay. I mean, he's been on Conan, and he's super funny. I mean, this guy's charisma is through the roof. But, you know, he just happens to be famous and – you know, someone that people would recognize. But we got a lot of submissions and we have like three people who were going to be like to have a little bit of a bigger segment because what they did was interesting enough and there's a lot to talk about. And then we have a handful of others that we're going to show. You know, it had to hit a certain note, right? So, you know,
So Jay's answer is yes, but I'm not telling.
Yeah, I'm not going to.
Can I show you something I made recently?
Yeah,
sure.
Cute, right? Yeah, it's like a macrame. I like did the macrame. I did the painting. I did all of
nice.
It.
Nice.
Yeah, I was very proud. Cool.
Good job, Gareth.
And now I'm blurry.
Talent.
There, I'm back.
My recent crafty project was I made a planter for the deck. So this is to put vegetables and stuff in.
Ooh.
And I made it out of old wood, so it looks very rustic. I actually made it out of my daughter's old swing set, which I deconstructed. I used the wood, which is aged really nicely, to make a planter. And the stuff that's growing in it is growing really well. I think for a couple of reasons. One, it's deep enough. So I made, you know, the dirt is very deep. But also it's very leaky, so it drains well. You know, I didn't have to put holes in it. The boards don't line up perfectly well. So it was like on purpose so that it drains well.
So you know our friend Joel?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Joel has a banana tree in his backyard that is it's flowering now.
Whoa.
It flowered.
Yeah, so it's an ice cream banana.
Oh, cool.
Really?
And he's going to send us some. So like, you know, I don't know how, Steve, you got to find out how long does it take from a flowering plant to the actual banana?
3 to 4 months.
Well, in Steve's case, 10 years. Okay.
I never got mine to flower. So
end of summer.
Is he coming to Atlanta? Is he going to be in Atlanta?
I don't think he is. I don't think he's going to go.
That's where we usually see him, right?
Yep.
All right, Evan, take us home with a quote.
The searching human mind is not satisfied merely to discover facts. We also want to know how things happen and why. Ernst Mayr.
Mm-hmm. Ernst.
Very nice.
Good old Ernst.
Why is kind of helpful. All right. Well, thanks to our live audience for joining us for this special
episode. This was fun. Thank you, audience.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.